You're listening to Toi Manaho, Designers Institute of New Zealand's DCAST, specifically episode 4 of Outside In, No Borders, a series where we explore the lives, perspectives and reflections of a diverse range of New Zealand designers who live and work overseas. My name's Brendan Jarvis, your host and the managing founder of The Space In Between, a behaviour-based design research practice and the home of New Zealand's first and only world-class human-centred design and innovation lab. You can find out more about that and some of the other things we do at thespaceinbetween.co.nz. With me today is our guest, Sophie Hamer. Sophie is the founder and director of Sophie Hamer Architecture, and as you've probably guessed by now, she's also an architect. Through her practice, Sophie works on projects in natural environments and cities, crafting spaces with a sense of stillness and connection to the surrounding landscape. Something that she must be naturally in tune with from where she lives in the Swiss Alps. Before moving to Switzerland in 2019, Sophie spent a formative 5 years at Fahrenhay Architects in Auckland, where she worked as a team leader and project architect. During her time there, Sophie's work was recognised with 2 gold pins at the 2018 Best Awards, and under her own banner, she's recently won silver at last year's Best Awards. Sophie is also the founder of Portico, a personal project that she started in 2015 to provide open and accessible resources, inspiration, and support for high school students interested in studying architecture, as well as current architecture students and early career professionals. Since it launched, the site has grown rapidly and now attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. Portico's positive impact has been recognised at home, with Sophie awarded the New Zealand Institute of Architects President's Medal, and also abroad, with invitations to speak at events all over the world. And now she's here with me to have this conversation on DCAST. Sophie, it's really great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
No, you're most welcome. You're most welcome. I've really enjoyed catching up with your career, Sophie, because as we were talking about before we hit record, it's been probably a decade since we last crossed paths on a project back here in Auckland. And you left Auckland in 2019 for Switzerland. I was curious, what was it that motivated you to move to literally the other side of the world to practice architecture?
Yeah, that's always quite an interesting question. Looking back, I guess, my partner and I were just kind of at the point in our lives where, I'd been at Fahrenhay for 5 years, which I absolutely loved, but a lot of ways kind of looking forward, I knew exactly what the future looked like, and I realized that that wasn't exactly what I wanted. So we kind of set out for a bit of an adventure and to take a bit of a leap and see what the world could offer us. We didn't plan on coming to Switzerland. Actually, I quit my job before I had anything lined up in Europe. A couple of weeks later, I was offered a role in Basel and decided that it was the thing to do. And so we moved over on that basis.
That strikes me as a really brave and bold decision to make. Is this pursuing the future and the unknown without necessarily having, you know, like you said, you didn't have a job to go to. Is this something that's in keeping with your character in terms of previous decisions you've made? Or was this a sort of departure to how you'd been living before and this was really a new and exciting chapter for you?
I'd love to say that I'm a very stable and focused and well-planned person. And in a lot of ways, I think I come across like that in real life. You know, I'm quite quiet. I enjoy my own space. I enjoy kind of a certain kind of regularity to what happens in my life. But when I look back at my history and kind of was putting together some notes for you about the changes I've made in my career, it becomes quite obvious quite quickly that a lot of the steps I've taken towards where I am now have been kind of exactly that. How can I put myself in a challenging position where I might be able to use my skills, learn some new ones, and see where I end up? I've never been particularly good at setting goals, like kind of thinking 5 or 10 years in the future, nailing something down and then working towards it. I've always been much more interested in kind of the journey or the process of getting somewhere and seeing where you end up without pre-planning it. So I guess that goes right back to deciding what to study at university. I actually only decided to study architecture about 2 weeks before the course started. I was all organized to go study law and chemistry in Otago. And during summer break, kind of started thinking it over and realized that maybe architecture was a better choice for me. So I stayed at home in Wellington and did that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, those are quite different directions you could have gone down. And clearly this move to Switzerland has been the beginning of something new for you. So when you think about your career, whether it's the early decision to study architecture instead of chemistry or whether it's this move to Europe and where you find yourself now, what has surprised you the most along the way? You know, what's been the biggest wake-up moment or revelation or whatever it may be, the thing that surprised you the most so far in your career?
So when I arrived in Switzerland, in a lot of ways, I guess I wasn't kind of aware of the scope of my experience in New Zealand. And a few people had kind of hinted this to me before I left New Zealand, you know, you're going to find out what you know, a few architects had said to me. And I realized quite quickly two things, one of which is that in Europe and probably in Switzerland in particular, they have very specific ways of doing things, which are very effective and work very well, but are kind of based on really dividing up tasks. And that means that in, for example, architecture and interior design, architecture and interiors basically never sit together. They're always kind of spliced. And it became super clear to me super quickly that my experience was actually very holistic in relation to what I was now dealing with, which was this kind of sliced up. The Swiss actually call it like a schnitzel, like very finely sliced kind of division of roles. A Schnitzdelen is the actual word, but... And that was really interesting to me. And the other thing that I found, which has kind of intrigued me and continues to intrigue me, is that one part of design that we always kind of talk about a lot, you know, going right back to university, is the value of communication, how we communicate things, how we communicate with clients, how we can get an idea that's formulated in our mind and translate it to something that other people can engage with. And for me, moving to a country where I didn't speak the language, the relationship of language to that became much more heightened. You know, typically in architecture, we might think about the role of a drawing or maybe a model to communicate something or a quick sketch. But suddenly the way that we use words, the words we use, the way that we use them in relationship to drawings and in conversation became really, really an important part of how I think about architecture and how I see different countries in Europe practicing and producing architecture.
Mm, that's really interesting. And I don't feel like I'm fully understanding the detail there. So go into that in a little bit more detail. So what was it when you arrived that it seems like you felt like you didn't have as complete a grasp over language's role as you do now? Like, is this what you're getting at? How does this actually work in a practical sense?
So I think it's, in a lot of ways, the types of words that are common in a language and the ways that words are put together. And I found that that kind of related to the way that architecture was being put together. So, for example, the way that in German or Swiss German, which is kind of a derivation thereof, you can kind of choose little parts of words and put them all together to create a compound word. And there are always ways of creating very specific words for different tasks or different components in a building or something. And then the way that the architecture is put together really reflects that same kind of breaking down and then building up again. So there's a very clear sense of not only the roles that individuals play within the process, but also like the individual components within that. And then working more recently, for example, in Spain, where they're speaking Spanish and Catalan, they're a lot kind of looser and more fluid with their language. And there are a lot more phrases that get repeated in order to kind of just keep the process going. And I think, again, that's kind of reflected in the way that the design process works and also that construction works.
Wow. Yeah, that's really quite a fundamental insight, isn't it, in terms of the rigidity or the, I suppose, the fluidity of the language that we learn or that we speak and how that influences the way in which we practice design. Just how much of the various languages and the clients, you know, that you're dealing with in Spain or whether it be in Switzerland, because there are quite a mix of different languages there, right? You spoke about Swiss German, you've obviously got Spanish, Catalan, you've got, I imagine there's a French influence in Switzerland as well. Like, just how much of these various languages in Europe have you had to come to grips with in order to be an effective practitioner?
I think you've probably summarized the main four there.
Okay. Damn it, I answered my own question.
When I arrived in Switzerland, I came into a firm where I was ostensibly going to go into an English-speaking role. And I was put onto a project where the client spoke English, but actually all of the kind of development group contractors, everyone else that I was working with didn't. And so within kind of the first week, I was sitting in big meetings that kind of the heads of some of the banks that we were working with were all there, they're all speaking German and Swiss German. In that situation, they could speak English, but they didn't. So I very quickly learned to understand, and then I could kind of reply in English and they would speak back in various iterations of Swiss German. So I learned quite a lot quite quickly in that situation, but it was very slow for me to start speaking because I wasn't quite sure what was coming out because I was hearing such a mix of Swiss German and German that I wasn't quite sure what my version was going to be. And so when we moved further south in Switzerland to where we are now, which is in more in the Alps, kind of closer to some of the ski stations, we're now in the French-speaking part. And part of that decision was because my French is a lot better. Basically, I learned French at school. I spent some time studying in France, and I can get by a lot better. The interesting thing, though, when we moved here was I realized I didn't have any of the architectural and construction vocabulary, which I had kind of a full suite of in German by that point, but I could barely talk about what the weather was doing in German.
So. Sophie, that this moving around, even within Switzerland and putting yourself, which sounds like to me in the deep end, is a fascinating way to, I suppose, keep feeling alive in your practice and always having to learn something in order to be effective in communicating that. I also got the sense from what you were saying earlier on about, it sounded like anyway, there was a rigidity or a deeper specialization in terms of separation between interiors and architecture. Like it works very well, as you said, for the European architects. But I got the sense there that it perhaps didn't work so well for you, because you went on to leave the firms you were working at over there and found your own practice. Am I reading something in here that doesn't exist? You know, what was the motivation behind going out on your own in a new country so early on?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that it was definitely a risk and there needed to be some kind of motivation there for me to take that leap. And also that, yeah, probably that kind of division played into it a little bit. So the role that I came over here for was really a little bit more focused on the interior side and actually trying to build that bridge between interiors and architecture within the studio that I was working in. But I found quite early on that it was kind of a bit difficult to do that because of some of those kind of social expectations around that division existing. Like my role was to build the bridge, but the bridge didn't really want to exist.
that sounds tricky.
Yeah, it was tricky. And I also realized that I really enjoy interiors, but my skill set isn't in kind of coming in when a space is already created and beautifying it. My skill set is in really creating great spaces, which means that projects that I work on that have the best outcomes, in my opinion, are the ones where I can be involved from the beginning, getting all the spaces flowing and working together in a beautiful way, creating an incredible atmosphere, and then flowing through the interiors and making sure that all those kind of finishing details really bring that space to life rather than doing one part or the other.
Yeah, yeah. And I asked you to send me through an image of a piece of work that you were really proud of or something that was of great, had great meaning to you. You sent me through a photo of the Blue Room at Campulia. So tell me about that. You know, I get the sense clearly this is something that you really value, this piece of work that you're proud of. But why did you choose this particular piece of work out of all the pieces of work you've been involved with in the past? Why this one?
Yeah, I was kind of tossing up between two images when I selected this one. The one that I didn't select was an image of a house that I've completed in New Zealand. And at the end of the day, I didn't select that image because it is still in New Zealand. And I thought, for the purposes of talking about what it means to work overseas, it makes much more sense to have an image that's based overseas. So the Blue Room is quite unique, I guess, in my portfolio, and that it's part of a project that we've just completed the first stage of, which will have a few more stages that run over the next few years. And it's kind of been my first opportunity to work with clients and kind of a client group that are really aligned with a vision of how we work with existing buildings, how we work with the environment around the buildings, and the kind of people that we bring to those projects. So the project is based in northern Spain. It's a very old masia, which is basically a Catalan farmhouse. So there's a number of buildings on the property. And the Blue Room is one of five guest suites that we've just kind of reconfigured and done up within the main house. And the property is owned by a pro cyclist and her partner, who are both originally from South Africa. And it functions as a kind of cycling boutique hotel. So cyclists from all around the world come there to stay for a week or so to cycle around Spain and enjoy the beautiful property at the same time. And I'm a cyclist myself, which is how I kind of got connected with them. And I'm very kind of interested in the project that they have, like the broader project in terms of connecting people, place, and cycling as kind of a way of engaging with landscapes and with this very special part of the world. And I guess at the time I selected the photo, that project had been pretty recently finished. So it was kind of top of mind. And the other thing that's quite important about it to me is, I guess, the use of colour, which is something that probably shied away from a lot more in New Zealand, but feels a lot more relevant as something to bring out in European projects where there's a lot more kind of existing material and different styles to act as kind of cornerstones for the design response.
Now that's interesting. So when you contrast New Zealand compared to, say, this property in Spain or the overall application of colour and architecture and interior spaces in Europe, what is it? It almost sounds like there's an absence of something here in New Zealand, or you know, maybe I'm projecting here, but what is it about New Zealand's lack of an embrace in colour or of colour compared to the Europeans' embrace of colour?
I mean, you definitely see some New Zealand practices doing colour and doing it very, very well. But I think on the whole, it always feels like something that's being introduced, which in a lot of ways, a lot of architecture is in New Zealand. It's introduced. And I think in some ways, because we don't have that long built history, we're often drawn to using nature as an inspiration and natural materials, which I also really love. But it means that a lot of the buildings are often kind of grayy, browny, beigey tones. And if you're using color, you're really saying, hey, I'm using color. Whereas over here, because there's such a longer history of building and construction and so many years of different styles that get layered over the top of each other, you're seeing colour everywhere, every day. And any project that you work on, there's usually something that's pre-existing that you might want to draw on. So, for example, in the Blue Room, actually, there were these beautiful vertical doors set halfway within the room that have glass set into them that were painted blue. And we thought, okay, let's take that and create kind of a complete blue experience for you to bathe in and use that as kind of the atmosphere, as opposed to saying, hey, let's paint everything white.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you what was the feeling that you wanted people to have as a result of occupying that space for that week that they were there. And I think you've touched on that there, but feel free to go deeper into it if you wish. The other thing I was going to ask you was, and it's, you know, clearly people can't see exactly what we're talking about here, so we're going to paint a picture in words instead. But you mentioned that this was part of a multi-phase project, and I think you said there were five guest rooms. So what is the, if there is, what is the story that's being told or the contrast that's being set up between this space and the other spaces that you're currently working on?
Yeah, so this space, these rooms are in the kind of ground floor of the main old house. So they're really They had all these kind of beautiful old coloured tiles on the floor. These are the spaces that the family used to greet visitors and their old kitchen. So this is kind of the more, kind of the richer, more opulent part of the house. And then upstairs, there in the future will be 7 more guest rooms, but those are kind of have a much more relaxed style to them, almost a little bit more kind of barn-like. You're up under the kind of rafter roof. The floors are still the existing kind of old terracotta. There's kind of a big pigeon coop up there that we need to do something with. So those are like kind of a little bit more pared back in relation to those parts. And then also on the property, there are 2 separate freestanding villas that had previous kind of renovation work done on them maybe 2 or 3 years ago, that maybe in a few more years we will come back to them again. And they have more of that kind of almost kind of countryside feel to them, much more kind of isolated rather than acting as individual rooms. You're able to kind of occupy the whole villa space.
Sophie, you've been practicing overseas now for roughly 4 years or thereabouts. How would you say your perspective on architecture and perhaps in relation to your own practice, how would you say that's changed in the time that you've been overseas?
I think my perspective on architecture generally, before I talk about my own practice, has just expanded a lot. I think probably in New Zealand, I could have named maybe 2 or 3 people that I thought were great architects that were very influential in the kind of style and aesthetic and approach to projects that I looked at. But since moving to Europe, I feel like that group of inspiration or that kind of level of influence has really expanded out for me. There's a lot more kind of niche areas in terms of, you know, some kind of Swiss designers from the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland that I've kind of got really interested in, or more kind of specific Spanish designers that I probably didn't have a whole lot of understanding of when I was in New Zealand, or I didn't have the context to value them in quite the same way.
Because you weren't there, right? Like you can't see. It's easy to look at pictures on the internet, but there's something fundamentally different about walking through the streets or walking through a space, isn't there?
Yeah, completely different. And also seeing those spaces in the context of what the other buildings are doing around them. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, I feel like some of the projects that I maybe revered when I was in New Zealand, I've come over and seen in Europe and realized that they're actually just a slightly nicer version of every other house in the street. But when you saw a photo just of that house, it looks amazing, you know? So that was quite funny. And then I guess in relation to my own practice, I've maybe shifted a little in terms of how I think about how architecture, or the role of architecture, I suppose, and how architecture can be offered and the value it can provide and the relationships you can form through it. So I think in a lot of ways, because I started my practice here basically not knowing anyone and without a network to kind of call on, I had to quite quickly develop quite a nimble understanding of what my skill set was and also how that might be applicable to people in different situations. And so the way that I kind of think about architecture now is a lot more flexible. I think about it as kind of a skill set that I have that I can bring to different problems. That doesn't necessarily mean that a client comes to me with a brief and then I say, okay, these are the 7 steps we're going to go through, and then you're going to have a house at the end, or you're going to have a hotel or something. It often means that a client comes with a question or with a site or an opportunity, or maybe there's not even a client at all and I'm just starting to kind of create my own project in collaboration with someone else. And I see an opportunity where I can offer a service that will get them to a great outcome that uses my design skills in a way that might be a little bit more flexible than kind of a traditional architectural approach. So I might jump in at the beginning, let the tradespeople come in and do some work, and then jump back in at the end, or find some other way that I can approach the project or kind of generate the project.
Is this a case of needs must, as in you're someone who's foreign, clearly you've got some amazing skills, but you're just establishing yourself. So is this a response to the current state that you find yourself in, or is this just the way in which architecture is practiced by independent practitioners over there?
I think in some ways it's a response to the current situation, but I also see it as something that longer term is also an opportunity. Like I was talking about before, that where I'm based in Switzerland, there's a very clear kind of process. Often that process, despite being very clear, is also kind of very dense and slightly impenetrable to potential clients, and especially to potential clients who might also be expats. Switzerland has a huge population of expats, and they might not, you know, have a friend's friend who's an architect who can help them on their project. So in a lot of ways, that kind of approach to architecture, using it more as a skill set rather than direct service, is a way that I can in some ways kind of create a niche for myself here, that I can kind of scope out a position that it works for me now, but I can also see it working for me longer term as well.
Speaking candidly, how have you been received as someone who's not from Switzerland? Like how easy or difficult has it been to scope out this position, to establish yourself, to get going, to get some runs on the board? What has that looked like? Have you faced adversity, or has it been something that's been really easy and everything's just come together?
I think it definitely would have been easier in New Zealand. I am under no illusion that I'm doing this the easy way. But at the same time, it probably has been easier than I expected. I'm sometimes not quite sure what I thought I was jumping into when I jumped off and decided to start doing this. But, you know, 2 years later, I've been quite surprised by the projects and opportunities and conversations that I've had, and how valuable those have been, and also how much it's kind of felt like the world has opened up to me through making those decisions, rather than kind of sitting in an office and doing work that other people were bringing in for me to do.
It almost sounds like you feel liberated by this decision you've made.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, there's difficult parts of doing it this way as well, but they're difficult parts that I definitely kind of enjoy at the same time. The challenges, I think, help you grow and help the kind of practice grow, and also help to kind of chisel that vision of not just what is architecture and what is this practice I'm building, but also like what is the life I want to lead, and how do I want to live in the world in relation to other people.
Now, there's a powerful metaphor, you know, chiseling the vision. What have been the things, or what aspects of this life that you're forming, what have been the things that you've had to let go of, or that you've chiseled off in order to help this take shape? Like, what are some of those things that you've had to change in order to grow into the person that you currently find yourself as?
I think a little bit was about that kind of almost relearning about what architecture could be and opening it up to be more flexible. So at the beginning, I was kind of quite set on, you know, this is how architecture happens, and I'm going to get all these processes in place, and I'm going to kind of sort out a really good business and get it all kind of running with all these templates and everything at the beginning, and be all set. And I think that part of chiseling the vision has really been kind of stripping off those parts that maybe I had learnt or absorbed from, I don't know, university or other practices or expectations from peers or any of those kind of aspects that were kind of driving what I was doing, and to really kind of look at what I wanted to be doing, see what was working, see what might get me closer to that vision, and kind of reform those tools so that they really work for me.
And growing a practice in any economy, any place in the world is a challenging thing. So anyone that's listening who runs their own practice or has done in the past will know what we're talking about here. What is it that you've done to get yourself on the radar? Because you've spoken earlier on how you're quite a, I think I'm using the right word here, quite a quiet person naturally. And growing a business there are these stereotypes that it requires this sort of loud and out there and brash and, you know, like supremely confident, verging on arrogant type personalities in order to do that. So what is it that you've done in order to attract the projects and to build this credibility that you're establishing over there?
I think from the beginning, I was kind of quite aware of exactly what you've just described, the kind of way that my personality and my way of approaching the world kind of brushes up against some of those stereotypes of what it means to run a business and to be a leader. But at the same time, I was very aware that I wanted to do this on my terms and to do it in a way that I could connect with people who I'm sure were out there that had similar approaches to life, to the world, that maybe were also quieter and didn't kind of resonate particularly well with some of those more brash approaches, and to find ways to connect with those people. So one of the things that's been a really useful tool for me is social media and being able to really use that to build relationships with people, whether that's suppliers, other architects over in Europe, press and media, or whether it's kind of connecting with expats in Switzerland or other people. Actually, I think almost all of my projects in Europe have come through a connection on social media. And often that's kind of just showing an interest, which is completely genuine, in people's work and what they're doing, and slowly building a relationship over time. Or in the situation where, for example, lots of the expats in Switzerland use Facebook as a way to kind of connect and ask questions and find information from other people. Often there'll be questions about properties on those kind of boards or renovations. And I don't stick my hand up and say, hey, I'll do a project for you. I stick my hand up and give some help. And then often, you know, that person might come back or someone else sees that I've been helpful and then contacts me out of the blue. So that's been a really good way of connecting with people from kind of my safe zone, if that makes sense, in a kind of quieter and simpler way. And then the other thing that I guess I'm starting to do as some projects are starting to kind of be completed is think about magazines or online blogs or other ways of kind of sharing those projects and getting them some visibility.
It sounds like your approach is very much the how can I help you without any expectation that it will be returned directly. It's almost like you're trying to create value in those forums, you know, across social media in these relationships. You're taking a long-term generative point of view.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of something that's always come reasonably naturally to me anyway. You know, when I was finishing university, I tutored and I absolutely loved that. And then, as you mentioned in the intro, set up my Portico website, which was exactly, you know, it's me writing about my experiences, writing things that I learned that were useful and sharing them with the world so that other people can find those things useful. So to me, I kind of was taking that skill set and that kind of approach that I'd already kind of developed and applying that to what does it mean for how I can connect with people that might help me grow my practice.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That line between those two things is really clear. Speaking of sharing experiences, I wanted to ask you about something different now, and that's about your experience as a woman in architecture. And I was curious to understand what, if any, obstacles have you encountered either in your practice in New Zealand or now abroad in Europe that some of your other colleagues who don't share your background might not be aware of?
Yeah, I think this question gets asked quite a lot, and in a lot of ways I find it difficult that it's kind of a woman in architecture question as opposed to all the other things that happen in architecture that are maybe swept to one side or not valued as highly as they might be, as well as women. So that's kind of, I guess, the kind of opening remark on that point. When I was at university, I definitely felt no sense of there being any limitations of me being a woman going into the field. I felt like the world was my oyster and any opportunities that were open to my male colleagues would also be open to me, and it was totally fine. I did find that when I got into the workplace, and maybe particularly also being in kind of leadership positions fairly young, so I think I was kind of in some kind of leadership roles and kind of important meetings and things like that when I was maybe around 24, that I started to feel like a little bit of that kind of tension, a little bit of maybe I was just being talked over a little bit, or maybe the ideas that I was bringing to the table were definitely heard and understood, but maybe they didn't hold quite the same weight that other people's did. And at that point in my career, I could never quite place whether that was about age or about kind of newness in the profession or about being a woman. They're all kind of tangled up for me together. And then when I moved over to Switzerland, I felt that in the same sense, because my role was kind of aligned much more to kind of the interiors. And like I said, trying to kind of build that bridge between interiors and architecture, there was a little bit of a sense of, you know, the classic kind of women do the interiors and probably don't know anything about the architecture. When previous to that, you know, I was very good at kind of understanding construction and structures and the kind of project management side of things. I was never just about making it pretty. And I also found that in Swiss culture in general, there is less, basically kind of, if you take the New Zealand history of women's suffrage and when women got rights to vote and place that, you know, on a page against when the Swiss women got their right to vote, they're absolutely poles apart. Some women in Switzerland couldn't even vote until after I was born, which is crazy. And it means that we're only maybe 30 years past that kind of point in history. And that means that there's kind of still a cultural lag in terms of what the expectations are around what women can do. It's not ever anything that's pronounced, but it does kind of mean that, yeah, maybe you're overlooked in some ways, or people kind of want to question things or want to assert the fact that they know what they're doing. And sometimes the way to deal with that is just to let them and carry on.
There's so much in there. And you spoke about how, especially earlier on in your career, it was difficult, if not impossible, to untangle why certain behaviors or certain experiences happened the way they happened. And I think even there in Switzerland, you've touched on the fact that it's not necessarily overt or pronounced in the way that these things happen. So perhaps my next question is a difficult one to answer. But speaking from your own personal experience and thinking about the future generations of women in the practice coming through, and feel free to expand the scope of how I'm framing this as you see fit. Mm-hmm. What would you change if you could change anything to help make the field more welcoming, more inclusive, or just different in some way than it currently is?
I think in a lot of ways it's kind of a step-by-step process, which means that the things that I think are important now and probably need to happen now are probably not the same as the things that are going to make a difference in 15 years. So at the moment, the things that I see as being valuable are basically finding ways to open up and validate different inputs into practice, which in kind of day-to-day terms means things that we've seen happening over the last few years, like an increase in flexible working, an increase in supporting good working hours, different working hours, different ways of engaging with kind of wellness and well-being within practice. In Switzerland here, just last year, they introduced parental or paternal leave. So all of those kinds of things that we're starting to see shifts on, I think in terms of making a difference for women in practice, are huge. And then the other thing I think is finding ways to really validate women's input into architecture, which you're seeing lots of groups across the world find ways to open up award systems to allow kind of placements for young women into architecture practices. And what I would love to see is that kind of expand to find ways not just to help women into practice, but to help women throughout practice to step up to leadership roles, to stay in leadership roles, to start their own practices, and to connect together to kind of support a different vision of what it means to be an architect.
What is that different vision? Like, if you were going to paint that vision, what is it and how does it differ to what we currently have or what is currently perceived to be the vision of architecture?
I mean, I don't think it's super black and white, and I think it's already kind of shifting, but that traditional vision of an architect that, you know, maybe is now already 30 years out of date or so, was always male, was always kind of dressed in a suit pants and a black turtleneck, and probably had some glasses as well, and always kind of told you how things should be. And I think what we're shifting towards, kind of more generally in society, but also in architectural practice, is softer in a lot of ways. There's more scope for questioning. There's more scope for a leader that kind of walks beside the clients instead of standing at the front and pointing their finger at what should happen. And that doesn't mean that every architect needs to be like that, but it means that the architects that operate in the best way possible in that way need to be like that. And the architects that need to wear their black turtleneck can keep doing that as well.
I like that way that you've opened it up to not necessarily replace entirely that old vision, but that it's almost like we need to augment and open up the practice to enable people who aren't going to fit that mold to contribute value to the space. I want to take things in a little different direction now, just before we bring things down to a close. And that is, from your unique position in Europe, in Switzerland, you're obviously in, you know, one of the epicenters of architecture and practice for architecture globally. What is it that you have seen or experienced in your practice in Switzerland and in the practices of perhaps of your contemporaries over there that you feel isn't maybe quite yet in New Zealand, but maybe coming soon? Like, is there anything that you're seeing on the horizon that's starting to play a role in shaping practice that practitioners here, although, you know, I will say that we do consider ourselves fairly up to date with things, but what might we be blind to or not quite aware of just yet that is going to play a role in the future?
I don't think these are potentially particularly forward looking, but two things are popping to mind. The first is that in Switzerland, there's a very strong culture of competitions, and competitions being ways to not only get projects, but to kind of launch new practices. And it also means that because the competitions are often kind of quite well paid, down to maybe, I don't know, the fifth place or sometimes further, there's quite strong kind of design culture that I think enables strong moves, strong design moves to be bred. And I think in New Zealand, a lot of the architecture is kind of limited by people not wanting to take risks. Not necessarily the architects not wanting to, but the kind of framework within which architecture happens, meaning that risks are not a good idea. Whereas over here, there's really that culture of kind of design comes first. Lots of people lean into competitions with very interesting new ideas. And even if they don't win, they're kind of visible to the public and they kind of become part of design culture and design understanding. The second is that the Swiss and the Germans are very good at building multi-residential housing and multi-residential housing with very good energy controls, very good thermal performance, very good kind of sustainability levels. And I think in a lot of ways, they're kind of world leaders in those areas. And New Zealand probably could be looking more to what's happening in this part of the world for how we're going to grow our cities in the future, because it's going to happen and need to happen much sooner than we probably imagine.
Two very important points, very important. And I would love to see us borrow some more from overseas. And I know that there are other people in the design community that would agree with what you've said, and that there's plenty of things we can learn from places like Switzerland. Now, just for my final question, Sophie, there may be some designers listening today who are of the mind or considering making a move overseas now or in the near future. What's something that you've learned, perhaps some piece of advice or wisdom, or perhaps something that you wished that you'd known before you left that upon arriving became important and something that you had to contend with? You know, what can you share with people, those designers, those architects that are thinking about going overseas, that would make that leap just a little bit easier for them?
I think I already mentioned this at some point earlier, but one of the things that a couple of people said to me before I left New Zealand was, you know, you're going to find out what you know. And I think that the longer I've been over here, the more that kind of rings true. Maybe it's at some point it kind of becomes irrelevant because it's just your life and you've been here for a while. But I think keeping that in mind when you first move, that there might be a big culture shock. People might be doing things differently, but that doesn't actually mean that where you've come from, what you've learned, the skills you've developed are wrong. It just means that there are different ways of doing things, and maybe you can find ways to bring value or shift some of the things that are happening that kind of makes what you can do unique, both within Europe, and then if you end up back in New Zealand at some point, back in that situation as well.
That's a really important point and note to finish on. Thank you, Sophie. It's been wonderful to spend this time with you. And thank you for sharing your stories and your insights with the New Zealand design community today.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Always really good to hear a Kiwi voice, and even better when it's a Kiwi voice that wants to talk about design and architecture with me.
It's been my pleasure. And to our listeners, thank you for being with us for this episode of DCAST, the podcast of Toi Manaho Designers Institute of New Zealand. Keep an eye out for the next episode of Outside In, No Borders. It'll be out soon, so now's a really good time to take a moment and subscribe to or follow the pod if you haven't done so already. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please don't keep it all to yourself. Share a link to it on your social, especially on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And when you do, tag us so we can say thank you for putting it out there. And if you feel really generous today, if you're feeling like you want to get this podcast out to more people in the design community, then please give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, because they're really helpful for doing that. Well, that's it from me. Have a good rest of your day.